Are you sure you want to join? One of the things that I've known for a long time now about many famous and infamous leaders in history is that no matter how difficult and how dangerous and despicable they were, they always believed that they knew what was best. Even if their tactics were unjust or even downright evil, they believed they were the one person best equipped to make decisions. And sometimes that belief got twisted, as we've seen particularly in the 20th century with the likes of Adolf Hitler and Stalin and Pol Pot and Idi Amin, etc. It's always seemed to be this way. Even the likes of Alexander the Great held ideas that thought gave them license to do whatever they pleased. Alexander, for example, believed that the Greek gods gave him the right to expend his soldiers in any way he deemed fit. The men under his command were simply tools to conquest and to his personal glory. It is with this in mind that I share with you a story from the later conquests of Alexander that reveal his conviction about his men and how far some of these men were willing to go in their obedience to him. Alexander was a very clever strategist and he possessed great negotiating skills. But one day he and his army encountered what could be referred to as an insurmountable obstacle. Alexander had divided his army to accomplish two different military goals, and the group that he personally commanded came across a city that was heavily fortified and defended by seemingly overwhelming forces. "Surrender immediately," commanded Alexander. And the king of the city just simply laughed. "Why should I surrender to you?" he called down from the height of the wall of the city. "We have you far outnumbered. You are no threat to us." But Alexander was ready for that challenge. "Allow me to demonstrate why you should surrender," he replied. And then Alexander ordered his men to line up single file and start marching. He marched them straight towards a sheer cliff that dropped hundreds of feet to the rocks below. And the king and his soldiers from the wall watched in shocked disbelief as one by one Alexander's soldiers just marched right off the edge of the cliff down to their deaths. After 10 soldiers had died, Alexander stopped them and ordered the rest of his men to regain their position in formation. The result of that little demonstration? The king and his soldiers surrendered on the spot to Alexander the Great. The king and his soldiers realized they could never defeat someone whose men were so utterly devoted to him, devoted so deeply that they would be willing to walk off a cliff to their own deaths. I'm sure that the question has crossed your mind after that little story. Why in the world did those men willingly march off the edge of the cliff without a protest? I also wondered in the back of my mind how the 11th guy felt just as he got to the edge. So how do you feel when I tell you that Jesus is calling you to just such a level of devotion to him? He calls us to pick up our cross and follow him. We ought to remember that the cross is what? It's an instrument of death. Jesus is calling us to die for him and with him. Jesus therefore commands us to count the cost of being his disciple to being his followers. And that cost, in a nutshell, is everything you have, everything you are. That being said, one of the things that should be on our minds whenever we study the scriptures is that each writer likes to stress certain things more than the others. And for the gospel writer Luke, one of the most important themes in his gospel record is discipleship. It's a prominent theme in the Gospel of Luke. It's also a prominent theme in the book of Acts. Whenever you read that, you should remember that. It is clear from Luke's writing that the early church wrestled with what being a follower of Jesus actually meant. How much such discipleship would actually cost each individual person. So in Luke chapter 14, Luke does something very interesting and also informative. Beginning in verse 15, he recalls the parable of Jesus about a man who holds a great feast and invites people to come. You know that story. However, many of the people who are invited make up all kinds of excuses why they can't come. And the host grows angry at the unwillingness of people to set aside their busyness to just come and celebrate with him. So he instructs his servants to go and invite everyone they see on the streets. Bring anyone, no matter what their situation is, as long as they are willing to come. Jesus' point in this parable is that the invitation to be his disciples is open to everyone. All that is required is a willingness to follow. And that sounds great. However, in verse 25, we read about the other shoe dropping. Yes, the invitation is open to everyone, but before you accept that invitation and commit yourself to Jesus, you better understand fully what it means, what it entails. Even the setting of this story is meant to make us see that there is a significant difference between following Jesus and being his follower. Following Jesus and being his follower. Luke begins in verse 25 by telling us that a great crowd was following Jesus, and suddenly, this is really interesting, suddenly he just turns and he addresses them. Picture that for a moment. Jesus is on this journey, ultimately going to Jerusalem, and right in the middle of somewhere, he just stops and he turns and he talks to them. He addresses the crowd. He's calling them to account. Why are you following me? What's your motivation for being on this journey with me? Well, let's be honest here that the vast majority of people in the crowd really had kind of frivolous motives for being there. We can speculate that they journeyed along in order to see more miracles. Get some more of that marvelous loaves and fishes they had. Maybe hear some more wonderful stories. Get some more teaching. Some certainly misunderstood what Jesus was all about. They saw him as a kind of political figure, a military revolutionary. They wanted to see Rome brought to their knees, so they followed him. Now it's clear from the Gospels that Jesus could easily draw a crowd. But how many people in those multitudes were really disciples or true followers? The gospel story reminded me of a scene from Brazil. It's been repeated many times over many years. It was a few summers back, and the Pope was in Brazil at Rio for the World Youth Day celebrations. Do you remember that? I saw news photos from the air of pictures of the beaches in Rio that were absolutely packed with millions of people who had traveled there to see the Pope and to celebrate a great big mass. Looking at that picture, I wondered to myself, why are those people there? What did they hope to gain from being present? Were they there to truly deepen their walk with God, or were they there because this was currently the big thing happening at that moment? Were they following Jesus, or were they simply following the crowd? Jesus is very blunt in Luke 14. Being a true disciple means walking in the way. It means walking where Jesus walks, going to the same destination he is going, which is Calvary. In the book of Acts, Luke even makes a point that the early church was referred to as the people of the way. You see, Jesus isn't looking for spectators. He's looking for participation. He's not looking for just a piece of us. He's looking for all of us. Furthermore, Jesus is upfront and blunt in telling the crowd the true cost of following him on the way. I may have shared this with you before, but one of the most difficult and unpleasant things I ever have to do is buy a car. Frankly, I hope no one's in car sales here. Frankly, I really hate the process. Oh, I enjoy the vehicle, don't get me wrong. I don't mind the test drive. The thought of driving down the road in a new or slightly used vehicle, well, that's kind of fun. What I don't like is the point when the salesperson takes you into their little cubicle and begins to haggle out the price of the car. Now, to be honest, I'm convinced that there's a great deal of sleight of hand with the figures in these negotiations. And then there's that moment where they have to go and talk to the manager. I think they're just in there talking about the ball game. I don't think it matters. And finally, seemingly after hours of back and forth, the price of the vehicle is agreed on and everyone seems happy. It's not over, is it? Mm-mm. Next comes the taxes. Well, that's not the dealer's fault. That's the cost of buying anything. And then you read over your contract and what do you discover? Well, there's an administration charge. There's a plate transfer charge. There's a fuel charge. There's prep charges. And suddenly your negotiated price evaporates. I confess, I go home from those experiences feeling like I've been taken advantage of. I really do. And that's why I'm a big fan of those new policies out there that the government brought in, all-in pricing. Have you heard about this? I don't know how it works yet, but I'm good. I'm getting on it. Don't muck around with me. Just tell me how much it is. Well, Jesus, in his call to discipleship, has an all-in pricing formula. He wants us to know up front what it's going to cost to follow him. And there's no way around telling you that the cost is very high. I've got no way to water it down. And Jesus won't let me and it won't let you. In this passage, Jesus focuses on three aspects of the cost of following him. And let us remember, he's addressing the crowd that was following him. Remember, he's standing on a road representing the way, and he's saying in part, if you want to go where I'm going, you better know what it entails. Yes, you've all received the invitation to follow, but are you prepared to count the cost? The first thing he tells the crowd is that following him means severing family ties. Jesus tells the crowd that love for him, loyalty for him, must take precedence over families. More than that, we must love Jesus more than our own lives. In a similar account of these words in Matthew, Jesus is recorded as putting it this way. If you love your father or mother more than you love me, you are not worthy of being mine. Or if you love your son or daughter more than me, you're not worthy of being mine. If you cling to your life, you will lose it. But if you give it up for me, you will find it. Jesus' point is that family can interfere sometimes with our keeping to the way. Our families may want us to go in different directions or pursue other paths. Families make claims on our time and our talent and our energy, which can keep us away from our duties as disciples. Jesus said to a man, remember back in Luke 9? Come, be my disciple. You remember that? Luke reports that the man said, oh yeah, I'll do that. But he said, oh, hold on a minute. Lord, first let me go home and bury my dad. And Jesus replied to him, let those who are spiritually dead care for their own dead. Your duty is to go and preach the coming of the kingdom of God. Harsh, isn't it? The second cost of truly following Jesus is that we've got to embrace radical self-denial. That's what it means to pick up the cross and to follow Jesus. In following Jesus, our self-interest is to take a back seat. The mission and ministry that we're called to is to be our top priority. One of the best ways of thinking about this is to realize that the cross itself is not a place of comfort. Oh boy. The cross, it's a place of pain and suffering and self-sacrifice. Jesus' point is that if we're not willing to suffer for the kingdom, then we do not understand him, and we certainly don't understand the nature of walking in the way. In the kingdom of God, there are no limits to any kind of thing that he may ask us to do. The more we base our security on our own abilities, on our own money, our own sense of righteousness, the further we are from the way. Finally, we need to consider that walking with Jesus means giving up material possessions. This is a hard one, isn't it? Jesus says in verse 33 that no one can become my disciple without giving up everything for me. This may be one of the hardest for those of us in the affluent West to embrace. In our society, the accumulation of wealth has almost become a religion for many people. We're encouraged to, at every turn, to make more money, to invest our money, to reap the rewards of money. Our society can easily be summarized by Kevin O'Leary of Dragon's Den fame, who used to be on the CBC program Lang and O'Leary. He also ran for the Conservative Party at one time. Every morning when I lived in Toronto, I was on my way to the church there. On CFRB radio, O'Leary gave a little commentary which he called the cold hard facts every day. In every single episode, and I mean every episode, he concluded his commentary by saying this: it's about the money. It's always about the money. I don't often agree with him. In fact, I rarely agree with him. But he's right about one thing. In our society, it's always about the money. Following Jesus means embracing the truth that it isn't about the money. It's never been about the money. Salvation means, among many things, that we are called to a different path than the world. The cost of following Jesus is very high, but are we willing to pay the cost? I mean, you wouldn't start building a building without first making sure you had enough money to complete it. I should have thought you wouldn't replace a roof on a church without making sure you had money for it, right? If you ran out of money, I'm going to really change things. If you ran out of money before you finished the roof, what would happen? Well, we'd get wet. People would laugh at us. They'd ridicule us. You wouldn't dream about going off to war, Jesus says, without first making sure you got enough soldiers to win. If you didn't, well, you'd go off and make peace first, wouldn't you? You know, Peter the apostle, when was faced with a decision like that in Luke 5, right at the beginning of the gospel, he was a fisherman. He loved his boats, he loved his nets, he loved his colleagues like James and John. It was his way of life. Fishing was what he knew. It helped him support his family. After that miraculous net-stretching haul of fish, remember that? With Jesus in the boat, we read that Peter, James, and John, I still am stunned by this every time I think about it, they just simply left everything and followed Jesus. You see that? They just left everything and followed Jesus. They left family. They left their boats. They left their nets. They left their income. They left everything to follow Jesus. Peter had no idea about what was coming, but he trusted Jesus and he simply followed. I always wondered in thinking about Peter how his family felt about him just letting go of his nets, leaving everything behind. Are you crazy, Peter? His wife must have said. Peter, how am I going to feed the kids while you go off with this man you just met? But Peter still went. Peter still followed. The way was rough. There were often no creature comforts to enjoy. And the whole incident of denial and trial of Jesus and the crucifixion tested Peter's commitment. I'm sure there were many moments when he would have longed to go back to the Sea of Galilee and back to his boat and his nets. In fact, in John 21, that's exactly what happened after Jesus' resurrection, isn't it? Peter returns to his old ways of fishing, only to have Jesus point out to him and call him again to repurpose his life, feed my sheep. So the question remains, are you just following Jesus? Or are you a follower of Jesus? Are you just doing Christian things? Or are you really a person of Christ? Are you willing to pay the price to walk in the way?